Pseudopod, episode 165, October 23rd, 2009. This week's story, The Cops, by Robert Mamone. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod Towers. Stay a while. Stay forever. Although if you do, we're probably going to have to work out some kind of housework rota. Anyway, horror. This week is provided by Robert Mamone, whose work has been appearing in various locations for almost 20 years. Most recently, he's been in the 7th issue of The Monsters Next Door and the 214th issue of the Doctor Who magazine. This is the first time The Cops has been published. When asked if there was anything Robert wanted his audience to consider whilst listening, all he said was a fragment of children's verse. If you go down to the woods today. Your narrator this week is Ian Stewart, so prepare for a little trip down some very, very dark paths. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Cops, by Robert Mamone. Standing in front of the mirror, hairbrush gripped tightly in one hand, Sarah looked despairingly at the bedroom's cramped reflection. Rumpled bed jostling for space with a rickety bedside table, leaving little room for the dresser jammed at the foot of the bed. And all this through a patina of fungus which had eaten into the silvered glass. The rest of the room was little better. High on the walls, paint had begun to bubble and peel, and the centre of the ceiling sagged. Reinforcing the general air of disillusion was a tattered cobweb of curtain stretched across the narrow window. Sarah tugged fiercely at her hair with the brush. Roger stood beside her, knotting his tie. The frown on his wife's face was all too evident. Touching her lightly on the shoulder, he hesitantly smiled. "Oh, come on, Soz, it's just for a little while, until we find a proper place." Down the hall, Sarah's daughter mumbled to herself a child's incantation that drifted up the corridor with its threadbare runner and peeling walls. "It had better be only a few months, Rog. I'm not sure I can take much more." She caught the hangdog look on his face and she softened. "I understand why we moved, Rog, really." Outside, the lamppost swayed against the stiffening breeze, the sodium blaze dipping and rising. Branches like broken talons scratched against the window, fingernails on a blackboard. The room was so cold, and thanks to Mr. Standish's ineptitude with a wrench, would remain so until the gas utility could spare the men. She put the brush down. "I just thought leaving the city for the country would be liberating. Instead," her glance around the room told its own story. Roger sat on the edge of the bed, shoulders slumped. When he looked up, his smile was forced. "It's better than losing the house to the bank. At least we've got some money tucked away, and that buys us time." The wind whipped up again, moaning around the eaves and throwing the branches against the window. Roger frowned. "I reckon if we let Standish trim that tree, he'll bring the bloody thing down on top of us. Honestly, what was that man thinking with the gas main?" Despite her mood, Sarah snorted and Roger smiled, relaxing a little. He leaned in conspiratorially. "We should try to look like we're enjoying tonight. I'd rather keep our landlord on side than not. Okay?" Sarah nodded, her face tight. "Just because we have to butter that old fool up doesn't mean I have to like it." Roger was about to respond when Julie bounced into the room, pigtails flying and her cheeks white. The bear she was holding stared blankly at him. "Why is it so cold, Daddy?" Roger thought she clutched the bear more for warmth than from childish habit. "If it was warm, I wouldn't have an excuse to give you a hug." Kissing her on the cheek, Roger folded her in his arms. With a laugh, she wriggled free and raced back into the hallway. Sarah smiled, feeling the weight shift from her shoulders. Grabbing her coat and bag, she turned, slipping her arm round Roger's waist. "Well, come along, then. Let's see what the Standish family serves up for us tonight." Hunched over the steering wheel, Roger kept one eye on the road, the other on his wife's efforts with the map spread across her lap. By the light of a pen torch clamped firmly between her teeth, Sarah traced a finger along a jagged line marked on the map. "Why in God's name would anyone live in the middle of nowhere? Oh, for goodness sake, Roger, slow down!" We can't be in that much of a hurry. Startled, Roger eased his foot off the accelerator, glaring at his reflection in the passenger window. Shifting in his seat, Roger allowed the car to settle into its new pace. Outside, moonlit silvered the pastures, slipping along the fence wire like mercury. Riding low in the sky, the moon lit the landscape in a pale light. Sarah pointed suddenly as the car approached an intersection. Turn right there, Roger. They should be just round this bend. Mouthing a word of thanks, Roger slipped down a gear and coasted round the corner. Speeding out of the turn, his attention was caught by a collection of trees lit by the headlights. The copse drew nearer, and he saw shadowy branches groping at the sky. Just as quickly, the light slid away and the trees were gone. A short distance away, a pair of stone pillars emerged, and Roger turned, driving between them and up the long, gravel-lined road leading to a large house. Finally! Switching the pen light off, Sarah awkwardly folded away the map. The car coasted to a halt, and Roger jerked the handbrake up. In the back, Julie kept up her conversation with the bear. Dried leaves skittered across the gravel, swirling around the car before disappearing into the dark. By the dashboard's dim light, Sarah was disturbed to see dark smudges under her husband's eyes. She opened her mouth to apologize for snapping earlier, when the porch light blazed and the front door opened. A shadowy stick figure emerged and jerked into life, waving at them. "Standish," Roger said, pulling on the door handle. A gust of wind snatched the door from his grasp and he had to scramble to catch it. "Come on, then." He stepped out of the car and waited for the others. Grabbing her bag and coat, Sarah got out and opened Julie's door. Huddling against her mother, Julie pointed up at the house. "Someone's in the window, Mummy," she mumbled, the bear stuffed against her face. Sarah looked up and felt a trickle of ice descend her spine. The face staring down at them looked like its features had been smoothed away. The feeling passed as abruptly as it came. "Oh, that must be Emma." She pointed and waved. The wan oval pressed against the window split into a grin. Sarah took Julie's free hand into her own, savouring the feel of it. "Now, let's go then. Now remember, don't forget your manners, okay?" Julie nodded, slipping free and skipping ahead, scattering gravel with each step. Roger pushed on the gate, wincing when the hinges rasped. Sarah planted a kiss on his cheek as she slipped past. He smiled. "What's that for?" Sarah looked coyly over her shoulder and smiled in return. "Well, if you have to ask." He laughed, surprised at how good it felt. "Welcome, one and all." Standish was a short, round man with smooth, pink skin. A tracery of white hair had been neatly combed across his head. Wet lips pursed, and he blinked owlishly from behind wire-rimmed glasses. Shaking Roger's hand, he nodded to the others, smiling.
"Hello, Sarah. Julie."
Bending forward, Standish dipped into his jacket pocket and pulled out a crinkled piece of cellophane. Sarah was about to intervene, but subsided when she saw Roger shake his head. Nodding her thanks, Julie unwrapped the sweet and popped it in her mouth.
"I hope you'll forgive me, Mrs. Hastings."
Without waiting for a reply, Standish ushered them in. Annoyed by his manner, Sarah almost missed the wood carving hanging by a nail from the door. She stared at it, aware that Standish's unblinking gaze was on her. Impaled on several wicked-looking thorns was the unmistakable image of a man. Standish let the door go and it began to swing closed, forcing Sarah to slip through the narrowing gap.
"Our Emma did that," he said, smiling. "Such a clever child, especially with her hands. Like your Sarah, I imagine."
They stared at each other for a long moment, while Roger looked on, clearly discomforted. "Yes," Sarah said firmly, "much like our Julie. Though perhaps her imagination isn't as well developed as your Emma's." Sarah matched Standish's blank stare as long as she could, until she broke the spell by looking over to Roger, who was helping Julie with her coat. He looked between the two, his brow furrowed. "You have a lovely house, Mr. Standish," Roger said, in the most soothing tone he could muster.
"My dear fellow, you're too kind."
Beaming, Standish led them down the hall. Sarah's lips quirked in distaste at the little man's posturing, but remained silent. Grabbing Julie's hand, Sarah looked round with interest. Like a sluice of blood, a crimson runner split the hallway's honey-coloured floorboards. Paintings hung at intervals on both walls, depicting dark forests and rural scenes. Passing an open door, Sarah glimpsed a room full of bric-a-brac. Wicker cages of all shapes, black books piled haphazardly on the floor, overstuffed chairs with split seams. Even bundles of long, thin branches could be seen. Her attention was caught by a fluttering movement inside a cage, but before she could get a closer look, Roger called out to her. Frowning, she moved on, noting a carving similar to that hanging from the front door. She noted with a thrill that the thorns on this one were much longer. They entered a large, sparsely furnished room. Thick drapes covered the only window. There was a long, low couch and a number of crammed bookshelves. Next to the door was a set of stairs that spiralled precariously into the dark. Sarah glimpsed movement in the kitchen through another door. A woman carrying a tray of drinks emerged from the kitchen. She was tall and spare, and the loose clothing she wore only accentuated the impression. Sarah noted with alarm the condition of her hands, all knobbed joints and cracked skin. Setting the tray down, the woman looked at each of them, her head bobbing bird-like on a thin neck.
"Oh, this is my wife, Margaret."
Standish vaguely waved a hand in her direction. Sarah thought her eyes distant. Sarah extended a hand and Margaret responded. The woman's hand was rough, like bark. The grip was limp and Sarah was glad to let it drop. Margaret's lips parted in a blank smile, revealing a set of large, blunt teeth stained a remarkable shade of brown.
"Would you like a drink?"
she said, her voice barely above a whisper.
"Thank you."
Roger plucked up a glass of light yellow fluid. Standish took one also, while Sarah shook her head, declining for Julie. Standish looked around.
"Where is that granddaughter of mine? Go fetch her, Margaret."
The woman nodded and scurried into the kitchen, emerging moments later with a child of about Julie's age. Her solemn face was framed by long dark hair. Sarah thought her eyes the most remarkable dark colour she had ever seen. Something glinted on her right hand, and when she drew closer, Sarah saw that it was a sock covered with buttons and bits of shiny thread.
"My son's only child," Standish said proudly. "Emma, be a good girl and show Julie your room. I'm sure there are lots of lovely toys with which to play."
Julie shrank against Sarah for a moment. Emma raised her sock-covered hand and proceeded to contort her fingers in the most amazing fashion, creating animals out of thin air. Julie broke into a smile, and Sarah was surprised to see her walk off with the girl.
"Mind your manners now, Julie,"
Roger called after her as the two ascended the staircase.
"You don't mind, do you?" Standish asked solicitously. "I'm sure the girls would rather spend time with each other than listen to our wittering. Margaret'll take some biscuits and milk up to them in a moment."
"You said Julie's your son's only child. Is he out of town?" Roger raised his glass to his lips. It occurred to Sarah, who was watching Standish closely, that he tried several times to shuffle his face into the correct look of sorrow before answering,
"Oh, sadly, no. No, my son has been dead 3 years gone."
"And the mother?" Sarah ventured, looking at Margaret closely. Her heavy lids slid down, then up, without any reaction.
"Oh, gone. Shot through."
Standish's reply was waspish. Sarah thought he was holding something back.
"But that's the past."
Standish quickly recovered his composure and raised his glass.
"To the future, then."
Roger returned the salute and took another mouthful. He smacked his lips.
"This is really quite wonderful."
He flashed a smile, lifting the glass and tilting it a little.
"Surely this isn't cider?"
Standish smiled appreciatively.
"Oh, it most certainly is. brewed it myself. I've several casks in the cellar.
Local apples? Sarah ventured, watching Roger take a deeper draught. Perhaps that copse of trees we saw on our way here.
Oh, indeed, indeed. My apple trees are the most productive in the district. It's the fertilizer, he said, winking.
Sarah felt goosebumps run up her arms. Standish set his empty glass down.
If you'd be so kind as to come this way, the dining room is through the kitchen. Margaret'll do the carving, of course.
His wife nodded, a strange, jerking motion. With Roger in tow, Standish led the way. Sarah, waiting for Margaret to follow, was surprised when she looked her directly in the face. Lips working soundlessly, Margaret mouthed the words,
"Go. Now."
"Margaret, don't dawdle, woman. Our guest must be famished."
Standish was suddenly in the doorway. He flashed Sarah a smile.
"Come along then, Sarah. We mustn't distract Margaret."
Margaret's eyes were blank once more, and she dutifully trotted into the kitchen. Her thoughts a jumble, Sarah watched Margaret leave. Standish stayed in the doorway, eyes probing. A sense of outrage mixed with unease settled over Sarah. Her jaw tightening, she ignored Standish and walked over to the staircase. She looked up, aware of the distant murmuring that drifted down. Sarah was about to call out to Julie when she felt a hand close over her arm.
"Come along, Sarah," Standish repeated softly. A thin sheen of sweat covered his face,
and she thought his breath smelled sweet, a mixture of cider and something earthier. Sarah pointedly looked at his hand, and it slid away.
"I trust you found your accommodation to your liking?"
Standish held open the door. Margaret stood over a tray holding the roast, carving knife poised to plunge into the steaming meat. She seemed oblivious to their presence. Sarah made a non-committal noise.
"Yes, it would be a terrible pity to lose it. After all, there are so few places in the village to rent. What would become of you then?"
It was said with such an air of innocence that Sarah missed the true significance until she'd settled into her chair, which Standish had pulled out for her. Her heart was beating a little quicker, and she mustered a faltering smile for Roger, who was onto his second glass.
"Fantastic stuff!" His voice was blurred. "We should ask Mr. Standish for a bottle or three."
He smiled to himself, then lurching a little, toasted Standish, who smiled encouragingly. Sarah lifted the bottle of cider and contemplated the ragged label fixed to it.
"You said you grow the apples for the cider, Mr. Standish. You also brew it on the property?" "Oh, it's a very old family tradition. Very old," his lips quirked. "The trees were here when my grandfather bought the land. It wasn't long before he started brewing the cider. Before he died, he passed the secret down to his son, a tradition I am happy to carry on with pleasure."
His voice trailed off as he contemplated the contents of his glass. "But you've no son to pass it to." Sarah took some little pleasure from her words. Standish looked at her, and Sarah was reminded of a lizard.
"Oh, it's true that Margaret's past her prime, but I've often found that something turns up."
He smirked, then looked round as the kitchen door swung open and Mrs. Standish entered, bearing several plates heaped high with meat and vegetables. She laid them out on the table, vanishing back in the kitchen to emerge once more with a jug of steaming gravy in one hand and a large loaf of bread in the other.
"Splendid," Roger said, setting down his glass and licking his lips.
Sarah laid a hand on his arm to calm him, but he shrugged it off, rubbing his hands at the feast laid before them.
"You can't beat country cooking, eh, Standish?"
The two men nodded a little conspiratorially. Sarah uncertainly eyed her plate, which was filled with bloodied meat and roughly chopped vegetables. She was startled by a thunk and looked up as Margaret began sawing into the coarse bread with a long-bladed knife. When she finished, she sat, looking expectantly at her husband.
"Grace, then."
Standish already had his hands clasped and head down. Surprised, Sarah hastily followed suit, her discomfiture increasing as Standish ran through his homily.
"O Lord of Green Pastures, We humbly thank you for what you have given us, and plead that our efforts tonight will placate thee. Amen, said Roger, too loudly. Plucking up his knife and fork, he took to the first morsel with relish. Sarah glanced at Margaret, whose eyes were resolutely fixed on her plate. Standish, delicately carving at his food, nodded encouragingly at Roger. His smile was wide and disarming, and in that instant Sarah hated him with a passion. "Oh, you've hardly touched yours, Sarah. Everything all right?" Sarah, her stomach queasy at the sight of pink-tinged animal grease congealing at the bottom of her plate, nodded with as much enthusiasm as she could muster. "Oh, yes, of course, Mr. Standish." She scrambled around for an excuse. I'm not used to such generous fare." "Ah, of course, city folk. Reheated dinners huddled in front of the television." He didn't bother hiding his condescension, and Sarah repressed a snarl. The room had grown stuffy, and she noticed her hands were shaking. Abruptly, she set her utensils down and pushed back the chair. Standish looked at her curiously, and Sarah saw Margaret's eyes were switching nervously between them both. "I should go up and check on Julie."
"Oh, no, please, stay," said Margaret, the sound of her voice a donkey's braying. "They were playing wonderfully together when I took them their biscuits and milk." Her words came out in a rush like toppling dominoes. "They're perfectly fine, really."
Sarah sat down again, resistance deflated. Standish nodded, satisfied. "Yes. Oh, yes, I just know they're having a perfectly enjoyable time." He pointed to Roger's glass, which was almost empty. "Top up, Rog?"
In the dim light, the bedroom pressed close. A dreamcatcher spun lazily over the single narrow bed, casting shadows that crawled around the room, rendering dark and secretive the expressions of the dozens of dolls amassed on every surface. Books spilled from a single shelf, their well-thumbed pages black with grime. A pair of wreaths hung from the dresser, woven branches laced with dried flowers, petals the colour of dark wine. The two girls sat huddled in the doorway of a long, narrow alcove, which served as a wardrobe. Between them lay a threaded needle, glinting on the worn carpet. On their hands were socks, thickly covered with buttons of all shapes and sizes. They giggled at the shadows dancing and capering on the far wall. Emma, her face creased into a smile, twisted her fingers, and the shadows hunched, then began stretching and stretching across the wall. Julie gasped, breaking into uneasy laughter, when the fingers contracted to normal size and broke into a whirling dance.
"You've got so many toys, Emma." Julie's voice was wistful. "Our new house is so tiny, I barely have anything to play with."
There was the sound of raised voices and a slamming door, then a sudden pounding on the stairs. Julie half turned, but was stopped by Emma. Julie saw that Emma was holding one of the wreaths.
"Come into the wardrobe," Emma said as the footsteps hurried round the landing. "Let's play a little hide and seek."
Julie offered no resistance as Emma pulled her into the narrow space and closed the door. Clothes of all description filled the room, leaving only a narrow gap down the middle. Julie shrank from the scratchy fabric, her nose wrinkling against the musty smell. She turned, trying to find Emma. The girl was at the far end, half hidden among the clothes. Julie struggled towards her, shaking off coats with their limp, clinging sleeves. Emma turned from the window, her head crowned by the wreath. Julie whimpered at the trickles of blood framing Emma's face. Emma's lips moved, the words lost among the rising wind, shrieking around the eaves in short, piping blasts.
"What did you say?"
"They're hungry tonight."
Emma turned and pressed her face against the window. A figure ran away from the house towards the copse. Smiling, she stepped away from the window and sat down. Moonlight shone through the ghostly radiance filling the tiny space. Emma raised her hands once more and began making shapes, which instantly came horribly alive amidst the folds of clothing. Trembling, Julie sank to her knees, watching the shadow of a man skitter along the wall towards the door, where the shadow of a vast, grasping tree had blossomed. The shadow darkened until it was a blot as dark as clotted blood, the clutching, straining branches reaching for the man. Almost delirious with fear, Julie watched the centre of the writhing mass explode outwards, revealing at its heart something even darker, which reached blindly towards her. Roger was enjoying himself immensely. He peered around the room, finding everything tinged with a gentle yellow glow. He smiled and nodded at Standish, relieved that the old man wasn't as bad as he'd originally thought. True, he couldn't fix a light bulb to save his life, but he laid on a decent spread. His eyes slid over Mrs. Standish, his stomach lurching at the thought of the grey, timorous creature staring blankly to one side. His gaze settled on Sarah, who looked at him disapprovingly. What was she scowling at, he wondered, taking another mouthful of Standish's delightful cider. Setting it down, he saw Standish was ready to top up his glass again. Was the old fool trying to seduce him? Giggling a little, Roger felt his stomach lurch. He waved the bottle away, feeling a knot of concern form in his chest when Standish frowned at him. The room grew stifling, and the walls seemed to expand and contract. Abruptly, he pushed back his chair and stood up. "Pardon me?" Roger was suddenly aware he was slurring his words. Need some fresh air." He cringed a little at Sarah's look of dismay and turned away. Loosening his tie, he hurried around the table, aware that several pairs of eyes were burning holes into his back. Stumbling into the kitchen, he went straight to the sink. He ran the tap and splashed water on his face. Groping for a cloth, he leaned forward, looking through the window into the night. Outside, the ground sloped away, broken in places by bergs of weathered rock. Under the moonlight, the outcroppings looked like fleeing figures, forever caught between the ticking of a clock. The longer he looked at them, the surer Roger was that he could see faces in them, staring straight at him. The thought sent a shiver through him. It was then he saw two small figures ghosting across the grass, hand in hand. "Julie?" Roger almost fell through the door into the dining room, his face white with fear. "Julie's run away, Sarah. Why's she run away?" The rest was lost in a morass of slurring, frightened words as he pathetically stumbled around looking for a way outside. Standish stood smoothly and took Roger by the elbow, leading him to a door tucked in the far corner of the room. His wet lips were murmuring something into Roger's ear. Frozen at the table, Sarah irrationally thought the words sounded like a nursery rhyme. The door closed with a soft click, and Standish returned to the table as if nothing had happened. Incredulity settled across Sarah like a soft, suffocating shroud. Margaret remained frozen in her seat, refusing to look Sarah in the eye. Standish had resumed his meal, chewing and nodding in satisfaction. Sarah's head began to pound in time with her accelerating pulse. "Are you just going to sit there?" Her voice rose with every word. "If Julie's outside, where's your Emma?" Standish placed his knife and fork down on either side of the plate, straightening them minutely until he was satisfied. He looked at Sarah, his round eyes unblinking. "Your husband seems a capable man, Sarah. I'm sure he'll have your daughter back in no time at all." He reached for the bottle of cider. "Here, won't you have some more while we wait?" Cursing them both for their lack of help, Sarah stormed from the room, racing up the spiralling staircase. On the landing, she glimpsed through a window, Roger reeling across the grass, his face blurred by distance and drink. When he at last vanished into the dark, fear gripped Sarah like a noose, and she began her search. All the doors she tried were locked. The last, half hidden in shadow, opened up into a child's bedroom, choked with toys and books. A door was past the rumpled bed, and Sarah hurriedly skirted it. Flinging open the door, she was dazzled by the moonlight, groping blindly forward. Blinking against the light, Sarah forced her way in, pushing clothes aside. By the time she found the girls at the back of the wardrobe, she was panting, her face running with sweat. In the chill moonlight, they looked like wax models. Sarah went down on one knee and held her shivering daughter close to her chest. Disgust wormed through her when she saw the thick runnels of blood leaking from beneath the wreath jammed tightly atop Emma's head. Sarah felt a brittle cold close over her, like a skin.
But if you're here, then what is Roger chasing?
With Julie clasped in her arms, Sarah rushed out of the bedroom and onto the landing. The oddly twisting staircase fell away in a cascade of light and shadow. Margaret crouched in a corner, hands over her face, muttering insensibly like a swarm of bees. Framed within the window, Sarah saw the copse, lit by the moon's chill light. A stick of shadow inched towards the thin tendrils of fencing wire.
"What's the fence for, Margaret?"
Sarah's voice shook. Margaret said nothing, and Emma's giggling filled the dark. Clacking buttons chimed in the air, a ripple of sound that left Sarah terrified.
"What are you keeping behind that fence?"
Sarah's voice dwindled, and she turned to the window once more, searching the sea of shadows for her husband.
"Roger!"
Out on the moor, Roger staggered along, shadows and grass twining around his feet. His head was thick with the cider, and the stars seemed to whirl round him in an endless gyre. A rush of nausea forced him to his knees, and he vomited, the wrenching sound filling the air. Wiping his mouth on the back of his hand, he heard a distant metallic hum. Several traceries of silver hanging in the air ahead of him sang in the wind. Beyond the fence, the trees were silhouetted against the star-speckled sky. The mournful sound brought home how alone he was. Looking back, Roger was disconcerted to see how far from the house he was. The face looking at him from the upstairs window was nothing more than a tiny white blob. Taking a deep breath, he closed his eyes for several seconds. Opening them again, he felt the fog in his head clearing. He decided to head back. What nonsense to think Julie would leave the house without telling them. The image of the running figures crossed his mind, and he hesitated, unsure. A sudden crackling noise snagged his attention.
"Julie? Emma? Is that you? Come on out, Julie. It's Daddy."
The wind dropped. In the silence, a branch creaked, shockingly loud. Then the entire copse swarmed with the sound, a fusillade which left him deafened and reeling. Trees swayed and branches clawed at the sky. Something flitted between the trees, a pale creature that could almost have been his daughter.
"Julie, wait!"
He ran to the fence, forcing down the bottom wire with a foot and ducking through the gap. Thick weeds clung to his pants, and he forced his way through, keeping an eye on the figure as it crept deeper into the trees. The droning of rubber on bitumen drew near, and he turned his head, flinging an arm up as twin beams of light scythed over him. In that split second he saw that all the trees were bone white, crawling with dead lichen from twisted roots to branch tips. Just as quickly as it appeared, the car turned away and the gloom settled over him again. Roger moved into the trees and found himself in a maze of tangled roots which covered the ground like frozen pythons. His foot became wedged. Twisting it back and forth, Roger felt the ground shift underneath him. He fell with a startled cry. Small shapes pressed against him. Shaking his head, he looked round and found he was sprawled on a thick carpet of dead apples. One close to his face reminded him of a baby's skull, and he shivered. A blind, pallid beetle crawled through a split in the side. With a cry of disgust, Roger scrambled to his feet, frantically brushing at his clothes. He hurried on, and after a few more steps, the trees opened up, forming a small clearing. Dead grass rustled dryly. The moon was centred above him, washing everything in a soft grey light. Clinging to a tree on the far side was the figure.
"Julie?"
His voice echoed, bouncing eerily around the clearing before it was swallowed by the night. The figure didn't move. Starting towards it, Roger felt his jacket snag. Lifting a hand to free it, he cried out as pain blossomed in his shoulder. Twisting his neck, Roger saw a branch spring back, the splintered ends daubed red. It plunged into his flesh again, driving Roger to his knees. Clutching at the dead leaves and mud, Roger struggled to free himself as pain exploded across his back. In one swift movement, the branch lifted him into the air. Around him, the trees swayed, branches crashing against each other with a sound like cannon fire. Long, wicked thorns burst through his skin. Tendrils of wood quickly raced along the veins, clogging arteries, finally erupting from his mouth in a choking frond. Arms and legs jerked spastically as he was lifted higher and higher. The ragged whistle emerging from his tortured throat was abruptly silenced when the branches convulsed, tearing his body apart. A steady rain of blood fell onto the greedy earth. Sarah felt as if a stone had lodged in her chest. Her body trembled as if in the grip of a seizure. The trees had stopped their thrashing, but the terror she felt increased. Emma's soft giggling continued endlessly on. At the limits of her tear-streaked vision, Sarah saw shadows leap and caper across the walls in a mad dance. There was a creak at the bottom of the stairs. With each winding step, Sarah's strength ebbed. When the sweet miasma smell of Standish's breath closed over her, Sarah closed her eyes. His wet lips brushed against her ear, and she shuddered uncontrollably. "Now you're mine."
We have no real concept of what old means. Old is not 10 years. Old isn't 50. Old isn't even 100. Old is when something has been around for so long you've stopped looking at it. Old is when you no longer see the wood, let alone the trees. Old is silent and immutable and cold and implacable. Old is. I'm overweight, though not by as much as I was, but I'm carrying extra weight. I'm balding too, which is why I shave my hair as close as possible. By any measure, I physically am regarded as a little bit of a failure because I like biscuits, I started losing my hair at an early age, and I'm short-sighted. I need glasses. I am big though, both directions, both tall and broad, and that overrides everything else for a lot of people. Because if you're a man, and you're big, then that means you must be physically capable, and we're hardwired to believe that's better than everything else. I'm the least alpha male guy I know, and I know some people view me as an alpha male because of no other reason than the fact that I'm big. I'll give you a case in point. A few months ago, I started doing boxer size. Didn't last very long for a whole variety of reasons, but the first session that I turned up at, the guy who was taking the class actually asked whether I'd done it before. I've never even been in a fight, let alone done any form of martial arts training, but because I'm 6'1" and built like a wall, he naturally assumed that I had. That concept, that idea that the alpha male is king, that's one of the oldest ones there is. It's part of our makeup, part of how a lot of people view the world, because might makes right, and thinking's for girls. And God, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the belief that if you stop and think and analyse something, then there must be something wrong with you, and the older concept that sits behind that. That if you're different to me, then you're wrong, I'm right, and I can mock you. And even better, when all I was doing was trying to help. My last year at primary school, I was bullied, just like I was bullied throughout the first 4 years of secondary school. I remember talking to my parents about it and them saying I should tell a teacher what was happening, so the next time, because it did happen again, the next time I was called fat, the next time I chased the two kids bullying me halfway across the school field, never quite catching them until I gave up. I did what I was told. I went to see the headmaster, and I told him I was being bullied. He called the two kids in, asked whether they were doing what I said, and they said, well, yes, but actually, they were worried that I was a bit overweight, and they were trying to help me keep fit. He slapped their wrists. He sent them on their way. The next week, it started all over again. My point is this. Old is all-pervasive, but old isn't always right. We act in ways that we're conditioned to, and we never once think to do things any other way. You see a flaw in someone, a fault, you shouldn't try and fix them, and you definitely shouldn't mock them, because it lessens you and it scars them forever. And anyone who says different, anyone, has never been bullied and never fallen on the wrong side of the system. No one is alone in the foxhole. No one gets left behind. And as a result, no one gets trodden on just so someone else can feel a little bit bigger. And just because I'm big doesn't mean you should be intimidated by the fact I'm asking for your money. Oh, ignore the bat as well. That's just for vols. Yeah, let's say vols. Anyway, Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you every cent is gratefully received. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod just wants you to relax. We need some information first.